All right, so this week we're going deep on a topic that's been lighting up our inbox, American liberal theology, specifically between the Civil War and World War I. And man, talk about a pivotal era. You had this wave of optimism, the sense that anything was possible. But at the same time, America was changing rapidly, cities exploding, science making huge leaps. And those traditional ways of understanding faith, yeah, those were getting some serious side eye.
It was a real crossroads, wasn't it? And the sources you guys sent, they really paint a vivid picture of how American Protestantism was grappling with all this change. Think Darwin, biblical criticism, all these new intellectual currents swirling around. It was a time of immense possibility, but also, let's be honest, some pretty big anxieties for people of faith.
Exactly. And that's what we're diving into today. How did some American Christians try to make sense of it all? How did they hold on to their faith while facing these new, often pretty skeptical ways of thinking about the world and the Bible? Well, it seems like a key movement emerged, classical Protestant liberalism. And our big question is, how did they attempt to, I guess you could say, save or revitalize Christianity in this new landscape? From what we've gathered, three main strategies emerged.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that these weren't like hard and fast categories. There was a lot of overlap and nuance. But looking at your sources, those three approaches really do stand out. The first one, and it's a real head scratcher at first, is what scholars call deifying the historical process.
Okay, deifying. So we're talking about making something godlike, right? But the historical process, help me out here.
All right, so imagine this. Instead of seeing God's actions primarily in miracles or specific interventions, these thinkers saw God revealing himself through the grand sweep of history itself. Think back to the Old Testament, how God is portrayed as guiding and shaping the destiny of Israel. They took that idea and applied it to, well, everything. God's purpose was woven into the entire fabric of history, unfolding over time. What's really interesting is how it shifts the way we understand God. It's not just about a God who acts in isolated moments, but a God whose very essence is intertwined with the flow of time and human events. That really changes how you view divine action and our place in the bigger picture.
Wow. So it's like instead of looking for God in those lightning bolt from the sky moments, they were seeing God's hand in the overall direction of where history was headed. That's a big shift for sure. And one of the sources touches on something that could be pretty controversial. This idea that God incarnates himself in humanity as a whole, not just through Jesus. Right. That's pretty radical departure from traditional Christian doctrine. Right.
It definitely challenged traditional views. It shifted the focus from the unique incarnation of God in Jesus to a more expanded sense of God's presence within all of humanity. Now, that didn't mean they completely rejected the importance of Jesus, but it definitely reframed it.
So if Jesus wasn't God in the traditional sense, how did they see him? What was his role in all this?
Well, from what we've gathered, they viewed Jesus as someone who was incredibly attuned to God, deeply in touch with the divine, and really understanding this historical process. So he became the ultimate example, the person we should strive to be like in terms of our relationship with God and how we understand God's work in the world. It was less about Jesus as the divine savior who died for our sins and more about Jesus as the perfect model of human connection with the divine.
So it was about following in his footsteps, so to speak.
Yeah.
And what about the idea of the kingdom? That's a huge concept in Christianity. How did they interpret that within this whole historical framework?
It's fascinating, actually. They didn't see the kingdom as some far-off heavenly realm that we're waiting for. Instead, it was the ongoing, unfolding presence of God right here and now, revealed through the progress of history. Less about a future paradise, more about God's work being realized in the present through human events.
Makes sense. Okay, so with this focus on history, how did they approach the Bible? It sounds like it wasn't primarily seen as a source of strict theological doctrines like in traditional Christianity.
Right. They viewed it as primarily a historical document, a record of God's actions and how God interacted with people in different historical settings. The emphasis was on understanding the big story of the Bible to figure out how God had been working throughout history. And personal religious experience, that was crucial too. They saw that as a key way to interpret and make sense of God's ongoing work in this historical unfolding.
But their view of religious experience wasn't about the typical themes of sin, redemption, that kind of thing. It was more about achieving that deep connection with God that they saw in Jesus, right?
Exactly. The focus was on cultivating a sense of being in tune with the divine, almost like having a similar kind of spiritual awareness that they believed Jesus had. That traditional Protestant focus on sin and the need for salvation through Christ. that took a back seat in this approach.
And the sources mention these biblical principles, these timeless truths like love and justice that they extracted from their historical reading of the Bible. It seems like that was a way to make these ancient texts relevant to modern issues and ethics.
You got it. They believe that even though the specific stories and situations in the Bible might be ancient, those core principles of love, justice, compassion, and mercy, those remained eternally true and provided guidance for how we should live as individuals and how we should structure society.
Gotcha. And it seems like this whole approach had a pretty optimistic outlook, this idea that the 20th century was going to be a Christian century. That's pretty hopeful.
Yeah, there was a real sense of hope that history was progressing towards a more just and ultimately more Christian future. But as your source points out, the outbreak of World War I in 1914, well, that threw a wrench in the works. The sheer scale of the violence and the horrors that followed those made it really hard to hold on to that optimistic vision of a divinely guided history smoothly moving towards a better world. It raised some tough questions about that whole idea of deifying the historical process.
No kidding. It's pretty tough to square those global catastrophes with a neat and tidy narrative of divine progress. So where does that leave us? Well, it takes us to the second strategy, stressing the ethical. This one sounds a bit more practical and action-oriented.
It was, absolutely. The core idea here can be boiled down to this phrase, life, not doctrine. They shifted the emphasis away from strict adherence to specific theological beliefs and focused instead on actually living a moral and ethical life. The argument was that being a true Christian was less about what you believed in your head and more about how you acted in the world, how your character reflected those values.
So it's about walking the walk, not just talking the talk. And again, Jesus was their prime example, right?
Yeah.
But this time, it's less about his divinity and more about how he embodied this ethical life.
Exactly. They emphasized Jesus's teachings about love, mercy, forgiveness, really highlighting those aspects of his ministry. And anything that seemed judgmental or focused on divine wrath, that was downplayed. They presented Jesus as the model of how to live a truly ethical life in relationship with God, and that ethical living was the true heart of Christianity.
And the source really highlights the importance of Christian education, especially Sunday school, as a key tool for instilling those ethical principles in young people. And that anecdote about the Sunday school that ditched the Bible in favor of cartoons to teach moral lessons, that's really telling. And then there's your own experience at Judson Memorial Church. Disney hymns, Coca-Cola communion. I mean, that paints a pretty vivid picture of how far some were willing to go to make faith relevant and centered on ethical living.
Yeah, those are pretty striking examples, and they show how some folks really went all in on emphasizing lived experience and ethical action, sometimes even sidelining traditional theological content and religious practices. The big question for them became, how do we live a good life? And sometimes they seemed less concerned with the traditional why behind those ethical principles.
It's like they were trying to skip to the practical part.
Yeah.
And the source then introduces some of the key figures who championed this focus on ethics. They make a distinction between guys like Henry Ward Beecher and Phillips Brooks.
Beecher and Brooks.
Yeah.
They were definitely part of this broader liberal movement. But theologically speaking, they generally stayed within the bounds of traditional Christian teaching, especially when it came to core doctrines like the Trinity and the divinity of Christ. Their emphasis on ethics was often more individualistic, focusing on personal piety and living a good life. And sometimes that took on a bit of a health and wealth vibe, this idea that material prosperity was a sign of God's blessing.
Right, right. And then there were folks like Washington Gladden and Walter Rauschenbusch, who are often considered the founders of the social gospel. They were really focused on how Christian faith should lead to social change and a more just society.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting that even Rauschenbusch, someone who's been called evangelical by some, was so deeply committed to that ethical transformation of society.
Rauschenbusch is such a key figure. He was deeply passionate about social justice, about how Christian faith should lead to real-world action to fight poverty and injustice.
Yeah.
And while he was absolutely committed to social change, his personal faith ran deep, too. The fact that some saw him as evangelical just goes to show how diverse this whole movement was. There were all these different theological perspectives within liberal Protestantism, but they all shared this core belief that Christianity should make a real difference in the world, whether it was about personal behavior or about transforming society as a whole.
Right. So it was about taking those Christian values and living them out, whether it was on a personal level or on a grander scale. So that covers two of the big strategies. Now, the third one takes a different tack altogether. It's what they call the centrality of religious feeling. This one seems to be all about that inner personal experience of faith.
You're right on the money. This third approach put the spotlight on the subjective experience of faith. It was all about individual religious experience, those deep emotions, and that personal connection to something bigger than yourself. It was about cultivating that inner spiritual life, that sense of awe and wonder.
And a key figure here is Friedrich Schleiermacher, who many call the father of liberal theology. He was dealing with this situation in Germany where educated folks were increasingly turning away from Christianity. They saw it as outdated, irrelevant. His mission was to bring those people, he called them cultural despisers of religion, back to the faith.
Schleiermacher was a brilliant guy, a real visionary. He saw that in a world that was becoming more secular, more focused on science and reason, those old dogmatic defenses of Christianity just weren't cutting it anymore. So he shifted the whole focus away from intellectual belief and doctrines and turned squarely on the personal experience of the divine. He said that even if you couldn't buy into all the historical claims of Christianity, you can still connect with its essence through your feelings, those deep personal feelings of dependence, of awe, that sense of being connected to something larger than yourself.
Wow. So he was intentionally downplaying the importance of dogma, doctrine, all those theological debates. It's about that heartfelt, gut-level experience of faith, that religion of the heart, right?
You got it. For Schleiermacher and his followers, religion wasn't primarily about believing a set of doctrines. It was about that subjective, deeply personal encounter with God, that feeling of reverence and connection. That was the core.
And that had huge implications for how they viewed the relationship between religion and things like science and reason. By locating religion in the realm of inner experience and feeling, they were able to say, hey, science operates over here, religion operates over here, and there's no need for conflict.
Exactly. They argued that science, education, art, all these different areas of human endeavor were valid ways of exploring the world. There was no need for religion to butt heads with them because religion was ultimately about this inner journey, this personal connection with the divine.
And once again, we see Jesus as the ultimate example. But here, the focus isn't on his divinity or even his ethical teachings. It's about his inner life, his constant and complete dependence on God, that unwavering faith and trust.
Right. He was the model of someone who lived in total communion with God through his inner life, his heart, his emotions. That's the kind of deep personal connection with the divine that this wing of liberal theology wanted to cultivate.
So there you have it. We've explored these three distinct strategies that classical Protestant liberals use to try and keep Christianity relevant and vital in America during this period of massive change. Deifying the historical process, stressing the ethical, and emphasizing the centrality of religious feeling. They were all grappling with the same basic question. How do we make faith make sense in a modern world?
And it's remarkable how much their concerns still resonate with us today, even though we're dealing with a different set of challenges.
Yeah, and it really gets you thinking. That first approach, trying to see God's hand in the overall flow of history, well, that gets pretty complicated when you factor in things like World War I, right? And the second approach, focusing on ethics, well, that's all well and good, but what happens if it's not grounded in any deeper theological convictions? Could it become a bit shallow? And the third approach, putting all the emphasis on religious feeling, that can be a powerful thing, but it can also be very subjective and maybe even a bit isolating.
That's the tension, isn't it? These are big questions with no easy answers. And the fact that we're still wrestling with them today, well, that just shows how profound and enduring these questions really are.
It's that constant push and pull between holding on to tradition and adapting to a changing world. That's something that people of faith have been grappling with for centuries. And maybe by looking at how these liberal theologians tried to navigate that tension, we can gain some insights into our own struggles today.
Absolutely. We can learn from their insights, their successes, and also their missteps. It's all part of this ongoing conversation about how we make faith meaningful in the world we live in. And that's a conversation worth having.
That's a conversation worth having.